Welcome to the Tulsa Music Stream. And now, your host, Scott and Janice Squires. You want the dirt? You've got it.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go. All right.
Okay, yes.
We're happening.
Now you're guilt.
Oh, my God. Good things come to those who wait and persevere.
Yeah, the phone looks great.
Yeah, that does.
All right.
How you feeling?
I'm fine, thank you. Yeah.
That was a good
time.
We
got them, guys. We got them.
Hell yeah. Thank you. All right. Fantastic. Let's get down to business because we have a lot of neat and fun things to talk about with you. I'm going to put this up on the screen. We're so excited to discuss this brand new album that's coming out. People can pre-order this at robertfleischman.com. This is Emotional Atlas. This is an all-electronic album. The only guitars on it are some bass guitars by Chips Enough. My first question for you, Robert, is what was the inspiration behind your desire to create an all-electronic album, and how long has it taken you to put this together?
Well, it's a big story.
Okay.
In the early 80s, I fooled around with doing an ambient album. And at that time, there weren't very many synthesizers around. There was the Moog and the Oberheim and an ARP. And so I had friends that had those synthesizers, and I would borrow one here and there for a week or so. And so I accumulated a body of work.
Yeah.
And I self-released it in the 80s, in the very beginning of electronic music, pretty much. The only person really doing anything really significant was Brian Eno at that time, and who I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
So years and years later, and I always wished I had put vocals on it. And so about 6 years ago, I just abandoned music, and I just been painting for the last 6 years. And then I have people and friends saying, "Hey, when are you going to make another album? Make another album." So I decided, okay, I'm gonna go for it. So I sit on my couch, and I plunk the guitar, and I just said, "I can't do this anymore. I'm over it." I was just sick and tired of the template of music. I mean, you listen to the radio, you go to a bar, whatever. It's all guitars. Everything is guitars, and you know, I've had the privilege to play with some pretty outrageous, great guitarists, but I was just sick and tired of it. So I decided that I was going to revisit the synthesizer and build a body of work with it. And it's taken me about 3 years to do it.
Yeah.
And I've wrote probably 18, 19 songs, and I've picked 10 of them. So...
So Tulsa, you're going to have 10 tracks on the album. It's, of course, it's titled Emotional Atlas. You also released a song called House on Fire.
It's great. Fantastic stuff.
Thank you.
Let me ask
really,
you.
Really happy to hear that.
So we were kind of expecting it to come out this month. Do you have a firm release date on this yet?
No. This little things technically are being... taken care of. Doing an album like this is very hard to mix because you don't have established characters. Like a guitar has a certain sound, you know, drums have a certain sound. Everything is just such a sonic overdrive of all these oscillating frequencies going on. It's just hard to capture it and not have it bleed into another one, so it doesn't lose its definition,
right,
per se.
Right.
So it's been quite a feat to mix this album. So we're actually just tweaking it still, and I think by next week we'll just start talking to labels, and also I'm going to manufacture a short run of vinyl and CDs, and then see where it goes from there.
That's exciting. Go ahead.
And
I'm sorry.
Of course, we're going to have that on Spotify as well.
All oh, the yeah, it'll be on all the digital
platforms.
A long time ago, when these platforms were in their infant stage, you know, you learned that you'd have to have a million plays to get $15, you know. So I really wasn't really on board with all of it. So I kind of opted out with Spotify and a lot of these digital platforms. And now I'm going to reestablish myself and get my catalog on there so I can die and leave some music, you know.
Like Perfect Stranger, I believe it. I know there's a few, a bunch of songs on there. I actually listened to a few of them, and I really liked World in Your Eyes. That was in 2002. So many cool tracks on there. I mean, there's like some heavy guitar riff stuff, and I was like, hey, man, this is like right down the Vinnie Vincent type realm a little bit on some of those songs.
Yeah. They were just sort of a product of the time.
Yeah.
You know, and what I was writing at that time. I've made several self-released albums, and they're all different. Each one is different from the other. I just don't believe in repeating the same pattern twice.
Yeah.
So I always try to make it more adventurous, or different production, or less production, or, you know, acoustic. So I like to mix around with lots of different colors of paint, let's say.
Yeah.
Sure, sure. And I'm kind of curious. We've met Chips. We actually have interviewed Chips Enough. Great guy. I want to know how you got to know him and how you developed a working relationship with him as well.
I have known Chip for maybe 6-7 years now. And we have mutual friends that we go to dinner parties with and little functions and all that. So we've become very close, brotherly-like friends. And I just decided, hey, I'm going to give Chip a call and see if he wants to play on it. So he played on quite a few tracks. There was a one bass player I used. His name was Billy Dickens.
Okay.
A funk bass player for this one song that I have called... Name of the Game. So I had him play on that. But otherwise, everything is all synthesizers. And I recorded them all at my house. I have a studio there, obviously.
He's quite a singer too. He's got kind of his own little style, you know.
Oh yeah. Yeah, we have colossal times.
Well, I know that, you know, he's got a lot of Beatles influence as well as you. It was that something that you listened to when you were a young kid, was listening to your parents?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm old enough to be your dad, you know? So, your dad twice over. Yeah, I grew up listening to the Beatles. I had a cousin who was 8 years older than I, and he turned me on to all the British Invasion albums. And one Christmas, I got a Norelco tape recorder, and I would use that tape recorder to tape the albums that I received that Christmas, which was Meet the Beatles, the Kinks, the Yardbirds, Stones. Yeah. And so I couldn't listen to them when I wanted to, because obviously they were in the living room. So I would record them on my little tape recorder and bring them to my room, and I'd listen to them that way. And then I would sing along with them. So I got to the point where I could really blend in. So I would, when nobody was around, I would turn on the albums in the living room and crank it up really loud and turn on the tape recorder and sing along with it, and then listen back to the tape recorder and hear myself if I could blend into it. And so I sort of got my ear that way. And then I would get friends, I'd get friends' tape recorders, and I would tape something on my tape recorder, play it back, record it on the other one, and then bounce back and forth like that, unknowingly. I mean, it was just like, I didn't know what I was doing, but it just made sense.
Wow. You know? What made
And I was like 11 years old, you know, wow. doing that, 11, just 12 years old.
When did you start to realize that you had a high range? How old were you?
Probably when I was around when Led Zeppelin came out. I could sing like Plant.
Mm. Mm.
Wow, you know, and that's something with
so, especially. But it was really funny because before Plant, there was Rod Stewart.
Yeah.
So everybody go, oh, you sound like Rod Stewart. So, you know, as singers came, you know, they go, oh, you sound like that. You sound like this. You know.
I don't want to get too disjointed on the story. I mean, we don't have to stay in chronological order, but sometimes it's easier to do so. But I know we want to talk about the journey portion of your life. As a matter of fact, let me just go there now. He and I we're musicians, and we always want to pick our guest's brain about the business side of music, which I know can be the dirty underbelly of all of it. But you know, we know you wrote three songs for Journey. You were a co-writer, Wheel in the Sky, Anytime, and Winds of March. So here's my question for you, without getting too much up into your business, I'm just kind of curious how this aspect works. When you're credited as a co-writer, how is it decided how the royalties are split? Because, you know, I would imagine that you do quite well with your royalties, but how is it determined who gets what percentage when there are multiple co-writers?
Well, if it's only two people,
sure.
Then then it's half and half, obviously.
Okay.
If there's three people, it's 33 1/3.
So it's that cut and dry.
It's not a record company gets portions of it.
No. You guys have to arm wrestle each other.
Okay.
but you know, I've never had any difficulty with it because I'm always the one that writes the lyrics and writes the melody, and then they do the music pretty much at that time in my life.
So is it lyrics and melody that constitute the writers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not the arrangement. Okay.
No. Okay. I mean the are you saying that the guitar chords are the arrangement?
Well, when you say melody, I guess I'm thinking in my mind like a vocal melody. But then if you have guitars come in underneath that, and they
it's written on a guitar,
okay,
and you write the lyrics and you sing, you get it's like half and half.
Understood.
Like,
okay.
You know, Neil was writing on the guitar. He was the bed of the music. I got inspired by the chords he played, and I heard this melody on top of it, and then the lyrics came, and so then you got a song.
Okay.
Amazing. Yes, amazing. And it's amazing on how you were able to get in, you know, connected with these guys in Journey, and that, I guess that started and was at Chicago, where you had a booking agent get a hold of you and come down to Chicago, and you played into some cover bands, and then... And then someone like a manager or promoter in Denver then got a hold of you.
Barry Fay.
And that's how you were introduced to Journey, by doing, I guess, CBS, a showcase. Yeah, a showcase for CBS. So how, I mean, what was going through an 18-year-old head? You know, what was going through you? I mean, you're going all these different places. Was it scary?
It was one of those situations where you know, you hear the guy and gets a part in a movie, and they say, hey, can you ride a horse? And he goes, yeah, I can ride a horse. So it was kind of like that. It was, everything was off the cuff.
Okay.
Completely. I didn't know what I was doing. I was in new territory. I just winged it, and I was lucky enough to have a voice that would pay off.
Right. I'm curious, this must have been a special moment for you when you got to do the Hollywood Walk of Fame with the guys in Journey. Who from Journey called you and invited you to be part of that event?
We all got an invitation, a letter from the management company.
Okay.
Cool. That's so cool that you were included on that.
Definitely.
Yeah, I really think that was the most terrific thing. As a kid living in Los Angeles, on Channel 5, they would always have on the news who was getting the Hollywood Walk of Fame star.
Wow.
And you would see it all the time, and you know, when you're a little kid, and then I was there, and I'm looking at all the cameras and everything, and I'm just like, I can't believe I'm here, you know. I've seen this on TV all my life as a kid, and here I am.
So you, right before Infinity came out, I mean, you were basically touring pretty much, was it nonstop with Journey after you kind of got on board, and you did a lot of, like, I guess, opened up for Black Sabbath?
I think we did like 78 shows, I think, or maybe less. I don't really remember.
Wow.
All I know is that it was a great experience. You know, I got to play Soldier Field in Chicago, and that was like 90,000 people there, and it was just unbelievable. Goodness. And funny story about that is they had the stage, and then they had this big catwalk that went into the audience, and on that end of the catwalk was my microphone. So the band is going on, and here I'm on the stage, and now I have to walk to the microphone on this catwalk, and I cannot remember the lyrics to the first song. Each step I get, it's like closer and closer, and my head is just ready to just explode. And then I grab the microphone, and I was like automatic pilot. It just boink, it just comes, and then it did the show, you know. But it was in front of the largest crowd of people I've ever did. It was, you know, all the stadium seats were filled, the whole field was filled. It was incredible.
So special. Yeah. Let me get to a viewer question. Steven Swanson says, did Robert ever work with Kraftwerk?
No, I never did.
Okay.
I think they're from Germany, I think.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Well, as far as Journey, I wanted to congratulate you for having that song on their box set for you. I guess you wrote that 1977?
Yeah, I did, with Neil.
Mm.
Yeah,
I'm gonna jump topics a little bit.
You know, the funny thing about it was they wanted that song from me to put on the Infinity album, but I said no.
Really?
Yeah, because I needed it for my album, you know, that I was making.
Understood. Wow. Talk a little bit about your relationship with Frankie Banali. We know he was beloved by a lot of people. A great guy from everything we've read and heard about him. Just share some special thoughts and memories of him, if you would.
Well, Frankie was the drummer for my Perfect Stranger album. We toured opening up for Van Halen, Sammy Hagar, Boston, I can't remember, an English band. Anyway, we did a whole tour. And a lot of it was opening up for Van Halen.
Wow.
And he was just the most loving, great guy. And we always kept in touch. And whenever he would come into town, wherever I was, if I knew he was playing there, I would always go see him play. So we kept close. Hmm. And it's sad losing your friends. And yeah, I miss him. I loved him. He was just a special chap.
He was. He and Scott and I have seen the documentary. It's the one with the big long title, but
that guy's his wife Regina produced that.
So good. His tenacity was unmatched. I mean, he just was a
absolutely
never give up guy, and so beloved by the fans. And
he
and,
was. He was a little samurai man inside of that guy.
I believe that with all my heart.
I think your story also with George Martin, you know, the Beatles fame, when he's listening to some of your songs and gave you a stamp of approval, that had to be something that was really cool. I mean, being a Beatles fan and you know, basically learning all of their songs when you were a young kid, and then here he is listening to you. What was that feeling like?
I felt like the Pope blessed me.
Yeah.
And then I got to meet him a few times after that again.
Really?
And he remembered, and I got to talk to him. And then later on, when the band Kansas dismantled, they were going to try to put it back together, and they had Ken Scott, who was the engineer for the Beatles, working on their new working on this new album. So I got called in to do the vocals for a song or two, and I was just in the studio with Ken Scott, and got to talk to him about, you know, recording Beatle albums and all that stuff. Nothing ever came about with the project. It just kind of dissipated. But that was another touch of the Beatles to you.
Yeah, wow. You know, you said when you were trying out for Goodwin up there, and I guess you had an opportunity to work with Asia, and you go out there. And I'm not sure what the dates were on this. Is this pre-Heat of the Moment MTV days?
No, that was the album that I was called to come into was that album.
Wow.
That so had those songs.
Okay. So, yeah. but you said that you had no idea, but the songs were tuned down, and it kind of gave you, you just weren't connecting vocally with.
It was not the sweet spot in my voice. Mm. You know, so I hear these guys are like monster musicians, yeah. And I'm just this kid that came off the plane, and now I'm going to tell them, hey, can you pitch it up another key or two, you know, do a whole different arrangement, you know, figure out how to do this, you know,
yeah,
and I just couldn't do it, you know, But the thing was I received the tape of the whole album prior to going to England. John Kolodner from Geffen Records gave me the tape, and I listened to it. And I love John Wetton from King Crimson and all that, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm listening to this thing, and I think it's great, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm going like, what am I going to do? You know, what can I do to this? Yeah. And so, you know, time flies by, and next thing I know, I'm on a plane, and I'm there. And I'm with these great players, and I just can't do it. It's not happening. So, but the thing was, I told the management, I said, look, this album is tailor made for Wetton. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like you wanting me to fit in a tailored suit for him and have it fit to me perfectly. And that's not going to happen. I said, Wetton is the guy. Don't worry what the record company has to say about putting a front person in front of it or anything. Just go for what you got because it's great. And that's how I left it.
Man, I mean, that's an example of your humility. Now, there, as we were researching you and I heard you recount this on another interview, I thought to myself, you know, now, as guys have aged, their bands are tuning down. I don't know if have you ever experimented with trying to sing with that stuff now and see if it fits your range more?
No, really? I had two experiences. Once I went to play with this band, and I just could not grasp it. And then I we had a break, and I said, "Are you tuned down?" Goes, yeah, we're tuned down a whole step, you know. And I'm going like, "Fuck, no, Matt, no, you know, that's why I can't attach myself to it. I couldn't." And then the same thing happened again. Foghat called me one time and wanted me to come play with him, and it was the same thing with that too. And I just said, and then he tells me, "Oh, well, when you ought to learn how to sing." And I'm just like I wanted to get his guitar and pop him with it. But so I sing in real tuning.
Well, yeah. That's good, because that means you haven't lost any of your range if you're still able to sing.
Well, I've had quite a range. So, through time, you know, it's like it gets stepped down a bit.
Sure.
I mean, you know, you can't run the 50-yard dash at 4.3 anymore.
Yeah.
Know?
Or here's the 80s, and
can you fit in your pants that you had when you were 20?
Let's not even go there. Don't even go there, man. Go ahead.
So the 80s, were bombastic. You know, there was fire, there was hair, there was loud guitars, there were, you know, amplifiers everywhere, and then there was Vinnie Vincent, you know, straight out of Kiss, and he's got these songs. He's an amazing songwriter. That's who I fell in love with, the Warrior. You know, he replaced Ace Frehley. He was cutting edge. He was something different, something a little bit more raw with Kiss. And people fell in love with that. And then he gets let go, or he's fired. I'm not sure which is which, but, you know, here comes the Vinnie Vincent invasion. And we're talking about some high singing and bombastic and a chaotic album. And I fell in love with it. It was amazing. I love your voice on it. It's just the way the guitars and your voice just go together. It's just crazy, but it's cool. And it's a cult record. And
it's a sonic onslaught of orchestrated chaos.
Yes, for sure. And you know, I wanted to ask you, you know, like, I know a lot of those songs came from Vinny, you know, from his Warrior demos and things like that. Which some of those songs went to Kiss. Some of those songs actually went on the Vinnie Vincent Invasion album. But even some of those demos went on the second album. Were there any of those songs that were on the second album that maybe you tried out and it just didn't work out, and then he just pushed it to the second album, or any kind of unreleased tracks?
No, you had that whole album pretty much written already.
Okay.
So that was the body of work. There wasn't anything else attached to it that was on any other album.
Okay. I didn't know if there was any extra songs or unreleased stuff that didn't get put out on that. Or
I guess the unreleased stuff is the one that album that he's been promising for a century or two.
Right. But you show up and you guys were, you and Vinny, you were, you know, going to do this thing before he was in Kiss. And then you, of course, gave him, you know, your blessings to go do Kiss. You said, you need to go do this. And you're in an apartment with these twins, and you need to go make some money, go do your thing. And then you guys get back together and to work on this project. But then his manager during the photo shoot gives you a contract, or I guess first he went to Chrysalis, I guess without you knowing, or something like that. Is that kind of where it started with the distance?
Yeah, it's
with
like
him?
This. We you know, we spent time together building this house, and so all of a sudden he sells the house, and I didn't know that he sold the house. And I didn't receive anything for my contribution to building the house. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of, that's the tale.
Wow.
Well, I want to ask a question about that whole saga, because you know, I listened to a Bobby Rock interview where he kind of tells it from his side, how he observed. Here's my question to you. We know that Vinny felt burned by Kiss. You know, they gave him a contract. He says they're paying him $550 a week, and that's it. And he gets this contract. I'm kind of curious, have he and you ever sat down and talked through, like, have you ever presented the question to him kind of like, you know, Vinny, you knew what it felt like to be given a contract and an ultimatum and kind of squeezed out. Why did you allow the same thing to be done to me?
Well, there's two worlds for Vinny. Mm. There's his world and other people's world. They don't get together.
Hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, he was offered to be with Kiss. He never signed the contract. They asked him many times to, and I guess he never did. And because he didn't, he came back home and he gave me a call, and we kind of put stuff together. And then later on is when he sold the project to Chrysalis.
Right.
And then all that happened.
Have you guys ever talked through any of this at all?
Time has gone by and everything, okay. And I always wish him the best of luck.
Understood.
I've talked to him a few times. You know, we did the thing in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. I got on stage with him for the very first time we ever played in front of anybody. And you know, Vinny's Vinny, and I know what he's like and what he is, and regardless of all the fiascos around him, I still care for him. You know, he's like an exotic animal. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So was Bobby Rock correct in that? I know that the studio sessions had to be tense, but maybe there was a point where the ice started to break a little bit and things were feeling better. If from Bobby's perspective, he felt like you were kind of warming to the idea of potentially going on the road and doing some shows with them. But then, you know, George Suet comes in and the contract comes in and it's game over at that point. Had that not happened, do you think you probably would have gone on the road with them?
I don't know. It would have had, you know, it would have had to been, I really don't know. I really can't say.
Okay.
Yeah. You know? I don't seek that kind of attention to be on stage.
Yeah.
You know, I go to clubs or go to concerts or see somebody play. And, you know, I get asked to come up and sing with them or whatever. Or people go, why don't you go up there and jam and stuff? I just don't do that. I love being in the lab. I love being in a recording studio,
yeah,
and trying to push boundaries, you know?
Sure.
And so... that isn't, I don't get off on that, you know?
Yeah.
I don't get off on doing that. I get off on creating something, writing a new song, finishing it, listening to it, mm-hmm, you know, go to the next one. That's my adventure. That's my, my forte, let's say. It's not really being on stage. I've never really liked being on stage.
It's amazing.
Sorry, people.
Yeah. It's amazing though, like through all of this and everything, and he had to go and of course get Mark Slaughter for the second album or for the tour and the second album. But Vinny seems to praise you quite a bit, and, mm-hmm, and he always has, and he's never slagged you, you know, one bit. Why
no,
do you?
Because I've been his best friend out of it all.
Mm.
You know.
Hmm.
Really.
Just a forgiving spirit. I mean, you seem like a...
Yeah, I have. I've been very forgiving.
Yeah. Well, he's fortunate to have you. I don't know. I don't know how many he has, but I'm sure he's grateful for you.
Well, I think it's an incredible record. And I know you, you have some song credits on there as well. What is it? Invasion. And what was the other one?
Rocks on Fire. No, Do You Want to Make Love?
Yeah, Do You Want to Make Love and Invasion, and great, yeah, songs. What are some of your favorite songs on that record?
I love No Substitute. Mm-hmm.
That is a good song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think those...
I love that song. And I like Do You Want to Make Love.
Yeah. And, Shoot You Full of Love is a good one, too.
Yeah. I mean, they're... you know, for me, it was a chance. I never sang that way. I mean, I did in other, you know, bands that I was in, but nothing like that. It was, that one was always like on 11, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was an opportunity to do it. And so I took it, and luckily it was like a matching tie and handkerchief in the sense that Vinny's guitar was just as intense as my voice was.
Yeah,
you know, so sure. it was a nice balance. It wasn't one was weaker than the other or stronger than the other. It was full on force of something to be dealt with.
Sure.
Now, you know, back on the streets, I guess that could have been a Kiss song later, maybe after Lick It Up, but you had the chance to sing it. But then it got covered by John Norm from a guitar player from Europe. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Have you had a chance to listen?
No, I'm sorry. They don't eclipse mine.
Well, you know, I like it because he kind of follows a lot what you did on there. You know, there's some changes here and there.
Why listen to him? Listen to me.
There you go.
Well, hey,
maybe he's paying tribute.
There's quite a few versions of different people singing it and all that. You know, it's just goes to show, Vinny writes a great song.
For sure.
Well, your vocal on it is just amazing. You knocked it out of the park. So, you know,
I wanted him to sing the whole thing. In the very beginning, when he played me all his material and stuff, I said, you should sing your own songs. You should just do an album by yourself. But he just didn't want to do that.
Mm. Wow.
And I guess it goes without saying, it's probably not too likely that you and Vinny will ever collaborate on material in the future, is it?
No, I think, never say never.
Yeah, sure. I feel you.
I can't believe he actually wanted you to re-record the vocals on the second album, All Systems Go.
That was a big door slammer. No.
Yeah.
Do you think he has so much resentment of you not continuing the project with him is why he kind of slagged on Slaughter a little bit more than, you know, because I thought that Mark Slaughter did a pretty good job. You know, I mean, he had a hard, a big task, some big shoes to fill, you know.
You know, for a long time, I had mixed thoughts about Mark, and then I heard an interview with him, and I realized this guy's really talented. He has such a great work ethic. He's a very nice person.
Yes,
personable. And I thought, you know, this guy's a really good guy. You know, he's a good guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, he got the opportunity to lip sync to my voice and, you know, he did it. But you know, he was 20 something year old kid and somebody goes, here, you know, here's the key to the Ferrari. You want to drive it?
Sure.
And yeah, he did. So, you know, God bless him.
Yeah.
You know, it's so cool that with you are like a part of the Kiss family, you know, and it's like Kiss fans have a way of bringing so many different musicians into the fold and including some of the Slaughter guys, you included. You know, you do some of these Kiss conventions, you've done these Vinnie Vincent conventions, you know, you get up and you talk to these people, you went and seen Vinnie, you got up there and sang with him. And then you also got to write a song with Gene Simmons, and it went on his vault. I guess I don't know how many he made of the vault where he would go and deliver them to people and everything. But what's it to you to be part of the Kiss family?
It's really it's a gift, you know. To be related to the Kiss family, to be related to the Journey family, to be related to the Vinnie Vincent family. You know, it's not like I played significant roles. I've played, you know, like a half a cube of butter's worth of, you know, being involved in it. But everybody decided to put me in the cake, you know. I'm there, so I really appreciate it, and I'm lucky. I'm a lucky guy.
Yeah, that speaks volumes for your reputation in the industry. I want to talk to you about The Sky. Now, this is a really cool project. This formed in 2009. We were checking out videos for One Day and Boomerang, and we were talking about them this morning. Scott kind of felt like there's a Beatles vibe, kind of a George Harrison vibe.
It's a George, it's kind of to a, me, it's yeah. a George vibe, Beatle-ish.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of Zeppelin in there, yeah. and there's some, even like some Oasis. It's, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah. Tell us about that project, how it came together. And I'm curious if it's going to do more in the future.
Well, that came about after I received the star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame with Journey. And so after the ceremonies, the band played at the House of Blues, and they asked me to come up and sing Wheel in the Sky on stage with them. So I got up on stage at the House of Blues, and I performed it, and I just thought, guy, I really love doing this, you know, being on stage with this great band behind me and just going up there and singing.
Yeah.
Then afterwards, I got a call from a friend of mine, a drummer friend of mine, who lived in Richmond, Virginia. And he said, hey, if you put a band together, I want to be the drummer. And then we talked for a while, and he said he knew some really great players in Richmond, Virginia. You should come down. So I flew down to Richmond, Virginia for a week, and I played with this group of people, which ended up being the Sky. And then I came home, and my wife said, you know, let's move. Let's go. And I'm just going, you got to be kidding me. And he goes, no, let's go. And so we went, packed up everything, went to Richmond, Virginia. I rented a loft. We rehearsed there. I did two albums there. The one's called The Sky, which was very like a garage band kind of punk rock kind of feel.
Right.
And then Majestic, which was much more produced.
Right.
And but the material, those two albums, I really love what I wrote at that time.
Yeah.
Wow.
Do you see you doing anything with it down the road, or was that kind of just a, you know, a phase, and now you've moved on from that as well?
Well, you know, I had to move from Richmond, Virginia.
Right.
And then I moved to Wisconsin, where my wife was from.
Sure.
And so we came here.
Okay.
Wow.
Understood.
Got a couple things that are on YouTube. We're live on YouTube, and we're live on Facebook and Twitter and Twitch. And a couple comments here from YouTube says, hey, Robert, huge fan. I have a question for Robert. Do you know much about the Vinnie Vincent unreleased song Invincible? Your vocals on that are amazing, really high up in the range. It's a great song. I listen to it a lot. Maybe those other demos.
I remember the title. It was way after all the fiasco with Vinny. I guess it's on. There's Vinny's got the same material, but they're called different albums. Like
Guitars from Hell.
Yeah, and then Guitarmageddon, or something like that. So, excuse me. So, yeah, I remember the song. That's all I can say, but thanks for asking the question.
Okay. Kyle Jean, Adderley basically says, how did the guitar, from Hell, Guitarmageddon, Guitarmageddon. Sessions come. Oh, it went away. I'm sorry.
Oh, here, I got it right here.
Okay.
How did the Guitar from Hell Guitarmageddon sessions come forth? And did Robert have hopes that round would have worked tour wise? The demos are amazing. If they were finished, they would have been out of this world. Rocks on Fire, Nuke It, Invincible Truth, etc.
Well, what happened was he'd done all the music. He called me up, asked me if I would come in and you know, do demos for him. And I did a bunch of songs for him. Then I think he got a deal with Death Row Rec? No. So what was the name of that company? Something Metal?
It's Metal Blade, Metal...
Yeah, one of these...
Metal Force.
No. But anyway, they gave them a deal. We went into the studio. We started mixing the record, and he just said, you know, this stuff sounds so good. I'm going to shop it. Mm. I'm going like, you can't do that. you just got money from this company that's, you know, footing the bill to do this right now. Now you're going to go do that. Wow. So yes, he did that. And then the lawyers from the other from the record company called the lawyers from the record company that he was with. And then it was an atomic explosion.
Mm. Wow.
And again, you know, shooting oneself in the foot.
Yeah.
So and then after that, I didn't want to have anything to do with anything.
Sure.
Wow.
Sure.
Well, I mean, just like I said, you're part of the Kiss family, and Paul Stanley, he loves to do his art, and so do you. You're into a lot of your artwork, paintings, and everything. What kind of sparked you to start that up, or was it music first, or did you paint first?
Well, when I was 13, well, actually, when I was even younger than that, I've always painted. I've done music. So when I'm burnt out doing music, I go and I paint. Mm-hmm. And when I'm through a painting, I go back to music.
Yeah.
So I ping pong back and forth like that all my life, fortunately.
I want to switch topics on you. You mentioned your wife. I know you lost her 4 years ago. You recently put up this really sweet picture of her on your page.
Incredible.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about her, some of your favorite things about her.
Well, she was the most empowering woman I ever met. She had the philosophy of bread maker, make bread. What do you need to make bread? You need an oven? Go buy the oven. You need dough? Go buy dough. You need this? Go do this. Do it. Just do it and make something, you know. And I was married prior to that, and I had the total opposite of that.
Okay.
You know, you can't do another album. It's going to cost money. You know, you can't put another band together. You're going to have rehearsal time and pay for that. And this, and you know, it's like, hey, I, that's what I do, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, Michelle was the most empowering woman. She was a geologist.
Mm.
She sailed boats from Fiji to Hawaii to San Francisco.
Wow.
She was in Desert Storm. She was a sharpshooter. She knew how to work a bow and arrow. She was an entrepreneur. She had her own physical therapy company. She was just amazing. One time when we were dating, I go to her apartment, knock on the door, says, "Come on in." I come in, and she's on the carpet with this whole computer completely dismantled around her. And I go, "What are you doing?" And she goes, "Oh, I'm just putting in a new hard drive." And then back in my head, I'm going, "That's the girl for me."
That's awesome. Wow.
You know, she was just incredible. And I miss her like nobody's business. And we have a lovely daughter, Violet.
Yeah.
I'm a single dad with a daughter, and I try to do the best I can. And I when my daughter asks me things, I try to think, well, what was it like for me to be asking that question when, you know, and I just think about it and go, yeah, go ahead, do it, you know? So, it's just a piece of her magic that she left behind for me.
So amazing. Well, we're sorry for your loss, but I know she was amazing, and I'm so glad that you had the privilege and pleasure of being with her all those years. So.
Yeah, me too. She was the best.
Yeah.
You know, it was, when she was passing, I would sit in this chair and I would hold her hand. And so she would said to me, you know, when I go, I want you to move. And I said, oh, I'm not going to move. And then finally, after 3 months or so, I had to move. I was going cuckoo.
Sure.
So she left me a list of houses to look at. And every house that I looked at had a body of water next to it.
Wow.
So one had a little creek going through it. Another one had a little pond. Another one was built around this man-made lake. And then there was the house that was across the street from Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
So I saw the house that was on Lake Michigan, and I really loved it. And I went home and I made dinner, and I come back and I decided to take a walk in front of the house. And the house is right on the strand, and you can walk and go down to the beach. And so it was at nighttime, and it was just hearing the water and doing this walk. And I just felt like, this is like therapeutic. I want the house.
Yeah.
So I'm walking back to my car. I noticed that the street is called is Michigan. So there it is, M-I-C-H, Michelle. My address was 2720. She died at 47. It has 5 bedrooms. My numerology numbers are 5. Boom. It was just like all
wow.
this stuff just in a row. And, you know, it's like, when people pass, they're always with you. You just got to learn how to read the signs.
Yeah, I agree.
They're always with you. There's always little signs here and there. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's incredible. You know, once you kind of like open up that little door inside of you to recognize.
That's so awesome, man.
And anyway, so when I decided to do the album, Emotional Atlas, and I bought all these synth gear, and I had my whole room set up. I needed a chair. I grabbed the chair that I used to sit with her and hold her hand in, and I wrote the entire album sitting in that chair. And the first song that I wrote was like, it was completely channeled by her.
God.
Completely. And the whole album is like that.
Oh my God.
I don't want to bring a spooky side to it, but it's
no,
not
no.
spooky. It's
no.
very, it's
beautiful.
Very godly.
Absolutely.
And Emotional Atlas is like an emotional map of your emotions.
So when you say you're the house on fire and she's the, was it kerosene? The fuel to the fire.
Is that about her?
They're all about her in one way or another. And there's poetic freedom too.
Man, we definitely that's kind of a perfect bringing this thing full circle.
Yeah, I do have one more thing.
Okay, please let me let you get to that. We've already been on with for an hour. We appreciate your time, but yeah, Scott, go ahead.
So you've done so many amazing projects, and you're so fortunate to write some amazing songs with some amazing talent out there. Do you have any regrets or you feel sad about some of them that you didn't go further along with? They were kind of some short spans, you know, for each one of these.
Yeah, but you know, it's like a battery. You know, you get charged here and you get charged there and you get charged there and you just become this battery of energy. So
yeah.
I've got each project that I've ever been involved in, I've always gotten tenfold energy from each project I went into. Even if I didn't complete the job, or I got only involved in it for a little bit, or whatever it might be, it just always charged me to make me to give me more confidence and to make me continue and to explore music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I approach music in a kind of a funny way. I approach it more like a painter, you know. I like Vinnie Vincent. It was like, you know, getting a big bucket of paint and just throwing it against the canvas and see what happens, you know. Yeah. It's that kind of approach.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the album
I love it when bands are adventurous. You know, a lot of bands, they get their first album, the second album, they try to repeat the first one. No, don't repeat the first one. Try to do something different. Mm-hmm. You know, you got nothing to lose.
I know you're getting ready to release this, but you're such a creative guy. I have to ask, do you already have the next album in mind as far as a genre, what you want to cover, what you want to do?
In a little ways, yes. I've been really getting into drum and bass. Mm. You know, drum and bass rhythms.
Yeah.
And I've been listening to a lot of jazz.
Yeah.
Kind of progressive jazz.
Yeah.
So I've been thinking possibly of like putting drum and bass and progressive jazz and use that to as my palette to compose songs and sing over.
Exciting. Well, we don't want
to. It's kind of out there, abstract, but you know, somebody's got to do it.
I asked that because I had the sense that there are no plans to slow down on your creations, and that's exciting news. And let's again put this up because I want to drive this home to everybody watching. Go get this album, pre-order at robertfleischman.com, Emotional Atlas. What we've heard off of it already is amazing. I know the whole thing is going to be amazing. Scott, do you have anything else before we let him go?
Well, no, I don't. But actually... You've always been a well-dressed individual. You've always dressed well. Where do you get your drive and your sense of clothing, your sense of
fashion?
Because you've always dressed really well.
Sharp.
And the journey thing, you know, we were kind of like having an argument which one you were in there. And I was like, Well, he's the one in the suit, I believe, with the tie.
Yeah, well, when I was born, they asked my mom if they want him with or without a suit.
I'm trying to find that. Okay. Yet, hey, so,
well,
let me.
You know, I'm a kid from the British invasion, and I always liked mod clothes. As always, like a mod all my life, even to this day and age. So I've always, I always love a 3-button coat and nice trousers. But I've always liked suits, I guess. I go somewhere and I'm wearing jeans and I'm wearing a t-shirt and I got a coat on and they just go, God, you look so good. I go, I've just got jeans on and a coat and a t-shirt. Give me a break.
You're right next to Neil and he's wearing like a flannel shirt.
Yeah, I mean, this is you in the middle, right?
Well, he just got through doing my yard work.
Picked up your groceries for you, right? Mm-hmm. That's so great. Oh man, you're the best. Well, we so appreciate this. Was so worth fighting through the technical difficulties. I knew it was going to be good. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for your time, everyone. Please go out and pre-order Emotional Atlas at robertfleischman.com.
Another thing is I'm going to probably have all the rest of my catalog available also.
Oh, great. Okay.
So all my other CDs, I'll probably sell it over Amazon.
Okay.
So I'm going to have it all set up on Amazon, and then I'll have Emotional Atlas. Then I'll have all the other CDs that I've done also on there.
Well, we'll be watching for that.
So you can buy a you can do a bundle or individual or whatever.
Okay.
So I finally getting to all this stuff that I have ignored immensely for many years, but I think it's time to get myself organized.
Yeah, I mean it's the way of the world now. You got to get that stuff out there online.
But, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I thank you very much for having me share my story with you guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a real pleasure.
Thank you.
And God bless you guys and your families. Yes, so you take care.
There's plenty of people in the chat room that has some questions and comments about... I'm just saying if you wanted to go back there and read them or anything like that, but I can read them now too. But I was just going to say if you wanted to share this on your page or whatever and let some of your fans get on.
You just give me the link we'll slap it up there.
Okay, yeah, so absolutely. Elizabeth English Talcott says...
You know what? Yeah. I want to say thank you for... investigating me and looking at different articles on me and being well equipped to ask questions and things like that. A lot of people don't, and thank you very much. I really admire that. That's terrific.
It's so fun. I don't know how anybody conducts these without doing the research. I mean, like, we've had a blast. And, you know, the thing I love about you, like, the takeaway that I take away from the last several days of research we've done is if people don't know you and haven't heard you voice your feelings about your career, they might say, poor Robert, he really missed out on some opportunities. But I just don't get that vibe from you. You have always been the captain of your ship. You've never let someone else come in and grab the wheel and take you in a direction maybe you haven't wanted gone. And I really respect you. I mean, like you said, the studio is your lab, and that's where you do your magic. And we just commend you for such a fantastic career.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. You know, the whole journey thing has always gotten to be so convoluted in the sense like, well, you were dumped and they fired you and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, oops.
But that was just because you had a different manager. Is that right?
Well, that, and it was sort of like, if you've seen The Godfather, it was a Godfather situation. Somebody from the record company, CBS, came to Herbie and said, look, if you take Steve, we'll give you more budget. We'll give you radio. We'll get you radio play. We'll get you a producer. We'll get you more tour support. We'll do all this for you if you take them. Well, so it's called music business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened. It was one of those situations. It wasn't that, you know, I was like a jerk or anything like that. I still talk to those guys to this day, you know. And I wouldn't have gotten the star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame if I were a jerk with them.
Of course
or
not.
Anything.
Of course.
You know, it's like prior to me, they were a rock jazz fusion band that played 15-minute songs.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
And then I came in and I was hired to be the pop rock writer and singer. And I executed what I was supposed to do. I forged a new template for them, you know. And they didn't even know who Roy Thomas Baker was. I'm the one who brought Roy Thomas Baker into the whole thing and who produced Infinity. Hmm. So, I was like the stylist in a sense. And I came in, I rearranged the furniture and they kept the template. And thank God they got somebody like Steve Perry to sell the candy bar. And they did. Yeah. And it's a great band. You go to a show, you see three generations of people, you know, soon to be four probably, but it's quite a musical journey.
Certainly.
Now, I know you recently, or you met Arnell. What are your thoughts of Arnell? Do you like the, his voice and everything?
Yeah.
Great guy.
Yes. I hadn't seen Journey for a long time. I went to see them play at the Greek Theater when they just got Dean playing drums and they had Steve Algeri singing. And I thought, wow, this is really great, you know, especially with Dean. He just kicked that band in the butt, man, just gave them, just put the powerhouse into them, gave them an edge.
Yeah.
And then Steve had to leave, and then they got Arnell, and Arnell is just a nice guy. He's a Cinderella story, you know. They found him in the dregs of Philippines somewhere, and he wasn't doing too well. Mm-hmm. And you know, Neil saw that video on him and took him under his wing. Hmm. Wow. So Arnell tells me that when he first got to San Francisco, he was going through customs, and the custom guy says, "Oh, you're the new guy for who's going to be singing for Journey, aren't you?" And he goes, "Yeah." He goes, "Sing Wheel in the Sky."
We tried to let you go, and it just didn't happen because we're having that good of a time with you. But hey, listen, I was going to tell you for the replay, like the link we're going to see, I'm going to trim this thing up so we get rid of all that technical junk at the start. So it'll start real nice and clean. But again, thank you so much for your time. We admire you and respect everything you've done. And please stay in touch with us so we can continue to help you promote things as you release them.
Thank you. I will take you up on that favor. Thank you.
Sounds great. Have a great night. God bless. Thank you.
Thanks
so much.
Thanks so much, Robert.
Peace. Take care.
Take care, my friend. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So cool. Yeah. You know, I didn't even know, but, you know, Vinnie Vincent's manager back then, George Sewitt, was also Ace Frehley's manager. So when he left Kiss, he managed Ace Frehley, and I did not know that.
I didn't know that either.
So yeah, I wanted to know what exactly were the details in that contract were that, you know, wasn't so flattering.
I don't know how how proper it is to ask about details in a contract, but we ask some personal questions,
sure.
Don't we?
He also, you know, back in the day, kind of played along with George Lynch, and
that's right. Right. Maybe we can have him back on. I he's so creative. I fully anticipate him to just continue putting out releases, and he doesn't like doing the same thing twice. So there's a lot of diversity there, and it's very interesting stuff.
But we appreciate each and every one of you for tuning in. Seagull Rock Squat on YouTube says AC/DC equals show business.
Yeah. There's our girl, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth,
Alcott.
Yeah. He's talking to pros at TMS.
Yeah, maybe semi-pros. I mean, I'll have to message you. I'll see you tomorrow. I'll tell you all about what happened at the start of tonight. We got through it, and that was a golden interview, and I'm going to trim that up real nice for the replays so folks can watch that.
It's amazing that we went as early as we did.
That was the craziest mess we've had in, gosh, probably a year.
Yeah.
I didn't
get to share it like I wanted to.
I know. That's okay. We'll share the replay. So let us tell you guys about what's coming up. This is so cool. We've been getting some requests for newer artists. When I say newer, I mean not 80s. And we've heard your voices and we're listening. So we have lined up these two very cool interviews coming up this Tuesday. We got to get on this one quick. Tuesday, April 2nd at 6 p.m. Central. We'll be talking to CJ Pierce of Drowning Pool. That's going to be awesome. And then just a couple weeks later, Thursday, April 18th at 6 p.m. Central, we have Bobby Amaru of Saliva on with us. Those are going to be two amazing interviews. And those guys are going out on tour together, right?
That's right. They just announced the second leg of a tour. They released some dates, and it starts, I believe, April 4th.
Okay. So 2 days after our interview.
Yeah, 2 days after our interview with Mr. Pierce, they will be going out on a tour and doing what they do, rock and roll. Yeah. And they let the bodies hit the floor. Yeah. Let the bodies hit the floor.
Don't distort the mic with crazy screaming now. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And we need to real quick, we're going to run through this real quick because we're running late tonight. DEB Concerts. I know the Lita Ford Last in Line show got canceled, but never fear because this one is happening Wednesday, April 24th. DEB Concerts presents Faster Pussycat with special guest Dime Store Riot. This is going to be at the Venue Shrine. Doors at 7, show at 8. Tickets are just $25. You can get those at stubwire.com. So make sure you go check out that show. It's always an awesome time when the Pussycat comes to town. Dime Store Riot's going to rock it as well. Thank you, Sycamo Filmworks. If you guys have any needs for a video for your band or business, email sycamo@gmail.com. Thank you, Dustin Little, for making our multi-stream platforming a possibility. If you have IT needs, boy, we sure needed them about an hour and a half ago, you can call Dustin at 918-640-0892 or email Dustin at okpc.com.
You did everything that anyone else could have done.
Oh, man, it was crazy. Do you guys want to have sharp-looking photos like the ones you're seeing on the screen right now? Well, get a hold of Greg and Jennifer Shipman at shipmanphotos.com. Your branding will be done right by those folks. They are top-notch. Do you need screen printing done? Get a hold of Todd at Identity Merch. Call 918-521-5660 or email Todd at identitymerch.com. We quickly told you at the start of the show. We'll tell you at the end of the show. You can always see us live or on replay on YouTube, Facebook. I guess it's called X now, Twitter, and Twitch. And make sure you subscribe and hit the notification bell on our YouTube page. We are getting closer and closer to 1,000 subscribers all the time. We can't grow without your support, so please help us out. And if audio is your thing, Spotify, Amazon, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, just get on there and look up Tulsa Music Stream and you will find us on there. You can listen back to these cool interviews.
Yep.
Holy crap, man. That was amazing. Quite an amazing. I want to check something here. Oh, yeah. Look at that. It's proof that stress does contribute.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you got stressed out.
Fly high, but Michelle.
There's really nothing you can do about it other than just, you know, you can always, always just record the Zoom interview. You're saying, well, how do we do that?
But you know what? We can, but we'll take this offline.
Yeah, whatever.
Anyway, it worked out great. We love you guys. Please remember, like we said earlier, join us back this Tuesday at 6 p.m., we're going to be talking to CJ Pierce from Drowning Pool. We're going to get the heck out of here and go to bed. Love you guys much, and we'll see you Tuesday on Tulsa Music Stream. Thanks for watching tonight. Good night.